Good morning, good afternoon, good evening, wherever you are listening from, and welcome to 1% Better, where we take a look at hidden stories in sports. I'm Zylan Fnake. Joining me now from high altitude in Sierra Nevada, so he's got an excuse for the lack of oxygen going to his brain. That is mean. I'm not going to say that. David Lipman, Dr. David Lipman, my co-host. Welcome to the podcast. Why am I being so mean to you?
It's your MO, mate. I would have gone with something like he's got a reason to be heavy breathing for a change, but whatever. Before we start the episode, I wanted to say a huge thanks to our sponsor, Precision Fuel and Hydration. So if you do go to their website and at checkout, you can use the code 1% better, all spelled out. The easier way to do that is to check our show notes. In the show notes, there is a link there which automatically applies the code and a link to their fuel and hydration planner, which if you follow the link in our show notes, will also automatically apply your code. Code is for 15% off on a one-time only order on your first order. So please do that to support them and support us. So much appreciated. But back to the episode, mate. I am going really well despite high altitude. I had a run this morning and was less out of breath than I thought I'd be, and my heart rate wasn't so high. I am astounded given that I'm still recovering from Berlin and I'm at this altitude, because previously up here, it's been horrid, mate. It has been so hard. So I slept better than I thought I would, which is usually even more difficult at altitude, and I ran better than I thought I would. So, mate, all good. How are you?
Man, you are in Sierra Nevada. I've seen that track. I've never been there, never been to Sierra Nevada in Spain, but I've seen that track that you ran on today. It looks absolutely stunning. In the mountains, views. I know there's snow at the moment, but that is just, it just looks world-class.
Yeah, mate, it's unbelievable. As I said on my Strava, it's my second favorite track in the world. The views are unbelievable, and just, I mean, the athletes around are very impressive as well, or whatever. But yeah, just really nice vibes on the track as well. Really nice and sunny.
I commented on your Strava to ask, what's your favorite track in the world then?
Yeah, the one at Nike HQ. You would have seen it on it. If you haven't seen it, check it out. There's all sorts of stuff on social media. Half of it's in like a wooded area. There's like beautiful trees around it. And then there's the Michael Johnson track. There's a statue of him there with his gold spikes. It's unreal. I headed out there a few years ago, did a bunch of videoing there. So it was fun. Really, really cool. So highly recommend, if you're in the area, you can run on it. It's free. It's open to the public, but you have to go. It's outside of Oregon, outside of Portland, sorry, in Oregon.
Sounds awesome, man. You've been busy. You are in Sierra Nevada. You went there via Berlin and the Berlin Half Marathon. How did that go?
I wish I'd gone from Berlin straight there. I actually went back to London to sleep. But anyway, Berlin Half went really well, mate. I ran 122. I think last week I said I'd go between 80 and 90. I think I'd said differently to you that like a good day would have been, I thought I'd go around 125. I thought it would be pretty much like what I was expecting. I went 122, which is quite a bit quicker. It was quite a warm day. People were dropping out everywhere, mate. I would have seen 8 or 10 of the elite or sub-elite women step off the course. And for different reasons, I don't know why, but lots of them went off the course. I really cooked my pacing, which is probably a testament to like how under-trained I am at the moment. But despite that, I moved through the field. If you look at my numbers, like at my splits, my 5K splits, I went through the field really well. So that was really surprising given how much I slowed and how much I cooked my pacing. So it speaks to how tough the day was for most people. Certainly the most I've hurt during a race in a long time, if not maybe ever, and certainly the most I've heard post-race in a good few years. I've run 50K ultras with 2400 meters of vert and hurt less than this. I'm sore.
When you say it was hot, what are we talking? What kind of temperatures are we talking?
I think like 17 to 20, somewhere there. Good amount of solar loads. Humidity was like 60%. So not like very, very hot, but for Europe at this time of year, coming off of the winter, it would have shocked a lot of people.
Okay, so I got a bone to pick with you, because the moment I start complaining about the cold where I live in South Africa and it drops to 17, 16 degrees and I complain about how freezing I am, you will not hear any bit of it. So, I mean, 20 degrees, come on, heat wave warming. I won't leave the house under 20 degrees, man.
Well, there you know why I give you hell every time you say it's cold, because it's not. But more importantly, I didn't complain about the heat, mate. I just said, given the conditions, and then I said it would have been hot for the Europeans. Like, I was happy enough. Like, it was a warm day. Like, we're cool. Happy days.
Funny. 20 degrees, heat wave, man. We don't touch, the weather department doesn't get in touch with us underneath 35 degrees over here. Yeah, I've been running as well. We're putting this out the day before I run Two Oceans, my very first ultra marathon. That is 56K. Last weekend I ran a 30K on a Saturday and a 10K race on a Sunday, but not as a race. And we had 4,000 people on the start line, biggest 10K race in the city. I didn't race it. I just ran it for the vibe. Super cool vibe along the coast. Last 3Ks coming back, running along the coast, I saw a pod of, must have been 100 dolphins. Super, super cool over here in South Africa. So yeah, feeling confident. I don't know if I'm naive or not. I've never run longer than a marathon, but feeling very confident to go and jog to Oceans Marathon tomorrow.
I am very confident. I've seen you, well, I haven't seen you, but I have seen that you have done things like had significant back pain on a bike ride and then run a marathon and run it pretty well. I've seen you run marathons and watched you pace them properly. I've watched you do 30Ks and then 10Ks on Sunday, mate. You forgot to mention, you know, sort of you did 30Ks on Saturday and then did 10K Sunday, both of which were good runs. So, mate, you're fine. You're in shape. You'll be good.
One thing we do need to talk about, we need to talk about it offline, but I also want to talk about it, maybe make an episode out on it, is, so to give people context, if you're listening for the first time, you are coaching me for these ultra marathons. And the goal is in Two Oceans. Two Oceans is a training run along the way to the Comrades Ultra Marathon, which is 90 kilometers in the beginning of June, which is why you had me running still high volume a week before Two Oceans so that I could get there on tired legs for adaptation. But what I do want to talk about is what shoe I should be running Comrades in. Should I be running it in a carbon shoe, etc.? That is something I've been thinking about lately, and I've watched some YouTube videos on it. I'd love to, as a podiatrist, as a shoe nerd, I'd love to get your input on that in the future.
Yeah, well, we've got an episode that we're planning on some research that's come out on super shoes, so we'll certainly have that come out, and we are also in a plans to maybe get a guest on to talk some shoe stuff with us, a guest who's one of the biggest shoe nerds I've ever met. And I mean that as a compliment because I love him and I love how nerdy he is about shoes. So he doesn't know yet, so we can't say his name, but I'm going to reach out to him and see if he'll join us. And that'd be awesome to talk some shoe stuff. And yeah, we can talk gray shoes as well, of course. So we'll certainly get there. And if you want to hear that, or if you don't want to hear that, let us know, send us a DM on Instagram or to our email address, both of which are in our show notes.
Yeah, so please subscribe to this podcast to not miss out on that. A lot of running coming up and a lot of equipment coming up to talk about. Do we have a community shout out this week before we take a look at what's come across your desk?
Yeah. So Matt Hawkins, a good friend of mine, went through my undergrad. He was a couple years behind me, but good friend of mine. And he has been sending some lovely feedback through. A lot of good feedback on the Nikolai Morris episode specifically. He said she was really, really keen and excited and really interested. He said, similar to me, but a female. So I think that's a compliment, Nikolai. Hopefully you take it that way. I'll take it as a compliment. And yeah, thanks for listening out, Matt, and thanks for sending some feedback.
Yeah, keep those messages coming. Also, quick shout out to a friend of mine who's just on the show, David, that I also have friends, Hishan Barner, for listening to the podcast. You and I did a brand podcast before this, and I know Hishan never missed an episode. Super cool to see him come across to this one, 1% Better. He's just moved to Cape Town to work at the Absa Cape Epic there, and he's been catching up on all the episodes we've been putting out. So thank you for the note, Hishan, and thank you that you are enjoying it. So yeah, follow us on Instagram and TikTok, 1% Better. We would love to hear from you. Now let's take a look at what has been going on in professional sports. David, should we start with professional cycling? You and I sort of talked about this last week, an absolutely horror, massive crash that happened in Tour of the Basque Country that took out a number of Tour de France contenders. You're not a big cycling fan, but you were very interested in this when you saw it happen.
Well, no, hang on. We didn't talk about this last week. We talked about another crash last week. There's a second crash that's happened, which leads us to a funny story. Last week, we released the episode talking about Wout van Aert's crash. And then I got an email from my dad, who happens to listen to the podcast as well. So shout out to dad, saying that we got the names wrong and that it was a different set of injuries or something. and sent us about this crash, which was Jonas Vingegaard has had a crash as well. Teammate of Wout van Aert. And so second crash. So thanks, Dad, for the heads up. This is how that came across my desk. But this is interesting because it's actually, you know, cycling injuries from crashes are all relatively similar because similar things happen. Crashes are different, but like what hits the ground is similar. And these guys are not protected. And the injuries from this, unfortunately, have been a lot worse in many ways. And we can talk a little bit about that. But mate, you sort of know this a bit. What kind of happened in the race and like what happened with the crash? We can talk about some of the injuries after that and go from there.
So it's actually significant that your father got the Visma Lisa bike ride is confused because it is their two biggest riders and captains, the riders they rely heavily on for the major results that have crashed out within 2 weeks. And that jeopardizes the team's whole 2024 season and what goals they had. Certainly, Wout van Aert is out of all the classics. He couldn't start Tour Flanders. He couldn't start Paris-Roubaix, which were his first two big goals and the two biggest classics of the season. Jonas Vingegaard, obviously, his goal is to defend his Tour de France title. He fractured some ribs, fractured his collarbone, so that jeopardizes his lead into the race. So that makes a big impact on the team's season so far.
Well, it's worse than that because when you fracture a rib, you always have a risk of what they call a pneumothorax, which is a collapsed lung, so to speak. So what happens is you can get a little puncture in the lung, it can then collapse, and it takes time to reinflate, and that's a significant issue for people who want to then exercise at a high intensity afterwards. So that takes increased recovery.
Does the risk of puncturing the lung happen during the crash, or are you meaning it can still happen afterwards while you're trying to recover?
So generally what happens is at the time of the fracture, the ribs, between the impact and the injury to the rib, it generally punctures the lung then. But you can certainly have these pneumothoraces can happen a number of times. And there is classically you see this in a tall, skinny person. They can happen spontaneously for no reason or no apparent reason. So these things, like the lungs are a lot closer to the chest wall than people think. They're a little bit more, you can have these happen. And then it's not a huge problem in many cases. There are some cases where it's a real problem, but the point I'm making here is really what this means for Jonas is that his recovery is going to be prolonged and he may have some increased challenges getting back to exercise, whereas someone like Wout, who had the risk of this happening but didn't have it happen, may be in better shape because, yes, he's got the pain of the ribs that are fractured that we talked about last week, and Jonas will have the same, but he doesn't have the collapsed lung there to deal with as well. And, you know, whenever you collapse a lung, you risk infection, you risk all these things. So he's certainly got a protracted recovery compared to Wout's recovery in that respect. So I'd say it's a good bet that he's not going to be riding the Tour de France. That'd be a solid bet.
Even though
bet.
It's April now. April, tours in July. Wow, okay.
Maybe on that timeline, I'm being a bit negative here. There is a chance he rides it. Can he win it and be in the best shape possible for that? That's a really interesting discussion because he's not going to be, we'll see. He can't be exercising at the moment, whereas Wout van Aert can probably get on a bike if he can tolerate the pain. I'm not convinced Jonas can get on a bike for a few weeks now, despite.
So that makes things very interesting, what you're saying, if you won't get there in 100% shape, because my opinion has been his biggest rival, Tadej Pogacar, was trying to win the Giro d'Italia, and then he'll go to the Tour de France as well. And I always thought that would put his Tour de France at risk because the Giro Tour double hasn't been done since 1998 when cycling was what it was back then. So, you know, from my opinion was who would put Tadej Pogacar on the back foot at the Tour de France. So it's interesting that this is a challenge that Jonas has to overcome now. The reason why this crash made headlines as well is because Remco Evenepoel was involved in the crash, Primoz Roglic was involved in the crash. So for the first time in a long time, you've sort of had all these big names in cycling spread out across teams, with Primoz Roglic previously having been Jonas Vingegaard's teammate and leaving Jumbo-Visma to join Bora-Hansgrohe. So that was exciting for the sport because now you have the four or five biggest riders all on different teams going up against each other. Four of those big names, or three of those big names, Remco, Primoz, and Jonas, were involved in this crash and had to abandon the race. So ASO, the organizers of the Tour de France, would not have loved to see that. Jonas coming off worse. It wasn't really nice seeing him lying there. They were on a descent. They came around a corner. There was a gutter next to the road. The rider leading the peloton sort of just slid out on the corner, and a bunch of them landed in this gutter. Remco landed on the grass. He broke his collarbone and fractured a scapula. Jonas was lying there for a long time, not moving. Yeah.
On that note, a fractured scapula is exceedingly painful and may need surgery, depending on where the fracture is. So, like, also a bad news for Remco.
Yeah. I mean, I hate seeing crashes in cycling, partly because I work in professional cycling. So a lot of these riders, it's not just a name that you read on a website or something. I know a lot of these guys, and particularly if it's a close friend, you just hate seeing this. So imagine what their family members are thinking, because Jonas was lying on the ground, they're not moving. You could see he was conscious, but he was not moving. So that was not nice to see. Roglic probably came off the best of the lot. He's just got a lot of skin missing. I saw a photo of him yesterday standing naked in a room and just patched up, looking like a mummy. Jay Vine, who is one of Tadej Pogacar UAE's key lieutenants, he will be in hospital for the next few weeks. Luckily, he needs no spine surgery, but he did sustain a cervical and two thoracic spine vertebral body fractures, and will be in a neck break for 6 weeks too. So really, really bad for him. 11 riders abandoned in this race. The race was neutralized for over an hour, which isn't common. That doesn't happen often in cycling, although we have seen it a lot this year. But the UCI president, David Lepatier, did come out and talk about this, because the stakeholders in the sport have actually started a project called SAFER. And SAFER is a project it's in the name, to make the cycling safer. And it's the teams and a bunch of the stakeholders that have funded this project. But this project is stalled at the moment due to what the Visma-Lisa Bike CEO Richard Pluger called politics being played. And the UCI president has come out and said, now is not the time for politics. They have to get these things going. And what SAFER, I think, has done is the last 3-4 years, they've studied all the crashes in the sport. And the USAP president was saying they've done a survey on it, and they found that 50% of the crashes are due to rider behavior, and then 50% are due to other factors such as obstacles that's not being signaled and the nature of racing and speed in the peloton, etc. But yeah, he also said that about 38 World Tour riders have crashed this year and have been seriously injured, which is a lot. It shouldn't be happening. So they are working on making the sport safer.
So it could certainly be random, and that's how things happen, accidents happen. They can happen in clusters, and like it looks like there's something causing it when there isn't. That's how statistics work. It is possible on a fair coin to flip 5 heads in a row. Don't get it twisted. What I am saying though is there anything that you're seeing that you think is driving this? And again, the answer could be no, but it seems like a lot.
It is a lot. They need to, opinions are a dime a dozen, but what they need to do is what they have been doing, is analysis and trying to get to factual reasons why this is happening. You know, I can just pull my finger out of my mouth and stick it in the wind and go, yeah, this is happening because the peloton is faster than it's ever been due to technology, etc. There's more money in the sport, you take more risks, etc. Like, riders are really working hard to do their jobs because it means a contract for X for next year or whatever. You know, this might be a contract year, so you want to prove yourself to your team, so you're taking extra risks, whatever. But those can all be factors. But yeah, I'm always of the approach of patience, factual analysis. Let's come out and get to the real problem and actually see what the real problems are. To give you an example, Paris-Roubaix happened last year, and there are often crashes into the Arenberg Forest when that cobble sector starts. So every single team and every main contender wants to be in the front. They want to be there. So it's a race for the entry to the forest, where the road goes from a double lane road that cars can ride to a single lane road. So it funnels it. So it's a recipe for disaster. So this year, the organizers and CPA came up with an idea to make it safe, and they built the chicane which made
that,
you...
That looked brutal.
Yeah, not just enter the forest at full speed, but they put railings on where you had to take a sharp right, make a U-turn, and then enter. And there were no crashes this year. It seemed to have worked, but the race was at such a high level that there were only 30 riders left at the front of the race at that point. The peloton was like so small. But race the race next year on a different result, different conditions, put the chicane there again, and you could have a different result. Like, it's just... It's hard to quantify. You need data. You need a lot of data. You need a lot of data points, I think, to come up with the appropriate change and measures that's needed.
Speaking my language, man. I love it.
Talking about data, etc. Last week we spoke about chest fairings in Ironman triathlon and them being banned. Is there an update on that? You came across an interesting article.
Yeah, I saw this article popped up. So the article is called CFD Analysis of Chest Fairings in Time Trial Cycling. Basically, they're looking at the impact of these chest fairings. Now, the article will be released. It's a May 2024 article. So we're looking into the future. It's released online first. That's how these work. But this is cool. They basically took a bunch of chest fairings, took seven of them that represented similar things. So like Gustav Iden from Ironman with the bottle, some of Jonas Vingegaard's stuff on his time trial. So they looked at some real life situations and then tried to recreate these chest fairings and put them in a wind tunnel and look at the effect of them. So it's to the, you know, the author said to their knowledge is the first time this has actually been done, which I think is really cool. They've no vested interest here. They did this on their own bat. I thought it was really cool. I won't go too, like, this article is, firstly, I don't know a great deal about aero, as I said to Robbie and as we said previously. Secondly, it gets real nerdy in this article, but the sort of high level thing is they took seven different chest fairings of different sizes and analyzed them. Five of them yielded a reduction in drag, and then two of them actually yielded an increase in drag, which speaks to kind of what Robbie was talking about in our second episode, which is like you kind of got to test this stuff and tinker and play, and then, you know, stuff makes sense and it doesn't. So you got to do that. The largest chest fairing gave a reduction of drag of 3.6%. Now, if you remember last week when we were talking about this with Ironman, we said that that reduction in drag isn't translated directly to improved performance in terms of 3.6% improved performance. What it does translate to is about 0.78 of a second of time gain per kilometer. So that's significant when you're talking about, you know, it's a couple of seconds. It's basically, you know, almost, it's like three seconds in 4 kilometers, basically. So like,
but why, I don't understand. I'm a little slow. Break it down to me. Why would you say it doesn't necessarily translate to increase in performance, but you're clearly getting a time gain advantage here?
Yeah, so that is true, but it's not 3%. So it's not a direct line. So improving drag by 3% won't increase speed by 3%. It will increase speed by a factor less. So in this case, 0.78 seconds. So it's not that, just like with the running efficiency increases from, like, you know, carbon plated shoes, you get a percentage increase in running efficiency. That will not make you 4% faster if it's 4% efficiency. That is more like 1% faster. So you don't have, because it's one factor in multiple factors, it's not going to be a one-to-one improvement.
You have to break it down to me like someone who only has a high school diploma. So thank you. Appreciate that. Got it.
Well, you're welcome. It's interesting though, because the UCI guidelines, unlike Ironman, the UCI guidelines say, items of clothing may not modify the morphology of the rider, and any non-essential element or device of which the purpose is not exclusively that of clothing or protection is forbidden. This shall not apply regarding any material or substance applied to onto the skin or clothing and which is not itself an item of clothing. So basically what this means is, because radios are seen as essential, they're not forbidden. And so they're using the radios down the front as a chest fairing. It's kind of how the authors of the study assume that people like Vingegaard have gotten away with it in, like, you know, the 2022 tour. So very recently. So it's an interesting thing. Like, watch the space for the tour this year. Let's see what they do with the chest fairing stuff. Let's see where they put them. Let's see where they put the radios. And, you know, one thing to note, this is very specific to time trialing, which is only one stage or a few stages of the Tour de France. It's not, you know, it's not every stage. These guys are not going to be wearing, you know, in aero positions and that sort of stuff for the whole Tour de France.
No, because generally for a road stage, your radio goes in on your back and your microphone will go on your chest, but that's a lot smaller than the actual radio on your back. But yeah, it's different for a time trial. No, interesting. Thanks. I didn't realize that. I'm definitely going to keep an eye on it for this year's Grand Tours. Should we move on to rugby quickly? And I am so fascinated by this because the Olympic Games always plants a seed in players' minds, and especially if the Olympics happens in your backyard, you might go do something that you naturally would not have done. Maybe I'm being very cryptic here. Can you give us context?
Yes. So I guess the rugby you speak of is rugby sevens, which is an Olympic sport, and there are two high-profile converts from 15s across to sevens this year. One of whom is Michael Hooper, who competed in the Hong Kong sevens over the weekend, debuted. The other one is Antoine Dupont, arguably the world's best 15s player. So obviously just had a disappointing Rugby World Cup with France, but has set his sights on playing for Paris, like for the France in Paris Olympic Games. And of the two, looks much more likely than Hooper. His skill set suits a little bit better, to be honest. He's probably a bit further along because he played a lot more sevens growing up. Sevens is not very common in Australia. At a young age, it is now, but not when Hooper was growing up. Where it is more so now, whereas for Dupont, he grew up playing a ton of sevens until he was like 16, and it's really showed. And look, his skill set and the way he plays rugby in general is more suited to that anyway. So he looked really good a couple of tournaments back when he played. I don't think he played Hong Kong, but Hoops certainly did play Hong Kong. And, you know, I read some reviews, saw some a little bit of footage. He had a really good steal in the Fiji game for them to beat Fiji. I'm not convinced he's going to end up making the team, whereas I'm pretty sure Dupont's going to go, and like it'll be impressive. Like that'll be super cool to see him play a Rugby World Cup and then, you know, less than a year later play an Olympic Games.
Dupont is a scrum half, if I'm not mistaken, and is he the best scrum half in the world?
Many think so, and I agree. He is. He also plays some 10. He plays some 10 for his club every now and again when they need it. So, like, he's just a very good generalist player and a very good scrum half. Kicks off both feet amazingly, good vision, really fast, really strong, quite big for a scrum half. He's like 90-something kilograms and very strong. So just pretty much the perfect sevens player, actually.
Yeah, I was watching the Six Nations documentary on Netflix, and he is featured in there. And man, the guy, you know, when you can spot talent a mile away, I always say you need talent to spot talent. But with a guy like that, it's so evident. Just the flair, the passes he makes, it's mind-boggling. I was laughing in that documentary because they would interview, you know, the managers from all the other teams, Scotland, England, Wales, etc. And they just give normal interviews. And then they would interview the French, and everything is a poem or a romantic analogy. I'm like, man, we are talking about rugby here. Can you calm down? But when they do talk about Dupont, I get it. I get that flair. I get that romanticism, that beauty of it. Then I'm like, okay, France, you can have this language, these beautiful analogies. Dupont actually brings it to life.
Well, that's the way they play rugby there, mate. That's how they see rugby. You're from a different culture of rugby where it's like Skopskis and Donner, like a bit of like, let's go, you know, Kappa Stomper. Like it's a real thing in South Africa, and it's very different to French rugby culture. And that's what's cool about rugby, that there are these stark differences in body shapes, game styles, ways of seeing the game, all that stuff. It's awesome.
Listen, South Africa, four-time Rugby World Cup champions. You decide which one works best. Right, let's move on to an incredible achievement from the hardest geezer, Russell Cook. What has he done?
He's run the length of Africa. Now, there's some debate about whether he was the first person, and I won't get into that because that's ridiculous. But he's, you know, it's 352 days, 1,600 kilometers, 16 countries, 386 marathons. Like, that's so much running, so much running. I've got an idea for a guest, and it's not Russ. He'll be everywhere else. Another guest who's done something similar, not similar to this, but done a lot of running, and want to talk to them about the changes in their body. And it'd be really interesting, I think. But this sort of stuff is getting more common. It's unbelievable. I saw footage of him running through a sandstorm wearing goggles, like just brutal. It's just like, why would you do this to yourself? Even to raise money for charity, it's great, but like, geez, it sounds tough.
Yeah, he raised over £700,000 for charity, apparently. He started in South Africa, the southernmost tip of Africa, Cape of Galles, and then ran to Tunisia. I mean, the stuff he had to go through, he apparently was robbed of money, passports, technology, etc. I think it was in Angola. I don't know if he was also taken hostage, if I read something like that in the Congo. Did you see something like that?
I saw some of this, mate. I didn't see a lot of it. I this guy came onto my radar very late. I'm surprised this wasn't on my radar earlier, but yeah.
His biggest challenge he faced was what all us Africans face is visas. That is what put this challenge in jeopardy. It looked like he wasn't going to get to, forget the armed robberies and all of that. Visa is the big issue. He wasn't going to get a visa to Algeria, which obviously is very, very north in Africa, and was going to put this in jeopardy. He made an appeal on Twitter, on X, that got everyone's attention and got millions of views. And the UK government got involved. And so much pressure that Algeria offered him a courtesy visa, which you get on the spot, because they were touched and inspired by the story too, which was cool. But he did experience some minor stomach problems. And then around day 45, apparently, doctors discovered that he had blood and protein in his urine. Is this something you would expect in a challenge like this?
Yeah, I mean, the question is how much? Because you can have little bits. So there's two things you can have. You can sort of have microscopic or macroscopic. So I can see it, or I can only see it when I test for it. It's kind of microscopic is like, I can see it when I test for it. Macroscopic is like, I'm peeing blood. There's a problem. So the second one's a real concern. The first one probably doesn't surprise me given what he was doing. He's running through very dry environments for a long time. He's probably like dehydrated. His kidneys are probably suffering a little bit there. He'll probably have lost quite a bit of kidney function. Whether he regains all of that is unlikely, but he'll regain a large portion of it, I'd suggest, maybe. The protein is a little bit more concerning, but you sort of don't know. In these contexts, it's really hard to understand what he was at baseline. I mean, he probably got some, hopefully he got some health testing done beforehand, and hopefully the stuff was normal, and then this is significant. But yeah, it's hard to know. Like, he could have had infections, could have been some dehydration stuff playing a role. Like, it's, the kidneys are fascinating. They're pretty resilient organs. You don't need both of them, and you don't need, so it's hard to know here, mate, but like, this doesn't surprise me. When I read this, I was like, yeah, it doesn't surprise me. Now, does that make it normal and healthy? Probably not, but that doesn't make it, out of the realms of possibility.
Yeah, so shout out to Russell Cook, man, also known as the hardest geezer. I had a bit of a chuckle to myself because while we were prepping this episode, I was Googling, like, why is he called the hardest geezer? I'm like, what am I doing? What more explanation do I want than the guy just ran the length of Africa? Like, stop being silly, man.
Yeah.
Should we crack on with some rugby news? You were alerting me early this morning, to the fact that the Rugby World Cup is going to be launched and happening, I think, from 2028. Rugby Club World Cup.
Yeah, this is a thing. They've been talking about this for years. This is getting me excited because I think we sort of need this thing. I actually think it should be 2 years out of the World Cup rugby. So I think you should have World Cup and then every second, and then 2 years later you have the World Club Cup. 2 years later you have the Rugby World Cup. So you kind of have this alternating, every 2 years you have a big rugby event that we can get around. That's not where it's landed at this point, but it's super interesting.
So why is this interesting? Because a similar thing happens in football. And to me, in football, it's like neither here nor there. I don't know how big it is. It doesn't seem that interesting. Why would it be different in rugby?
Because the hemispheres are so separate. Because there's this north-south hemisphere divide in terms of game styles and cultures and that sort of stuff. And in football, everything is club-based. Whereas in rugby, I mean, yes, there's a football World Cup and people care about it, but like, the Rugby World Cup is the pinnacle at the moment, and that's great. And club is kind of secondary by a long shot. And I'd say in some respects it's similar. I don't know. It's hard to understand the football culture, but there's just a lot more football played, I guess, is another reason. And there's lots more tournaments and trophies, and you can just add stuff. And so it starts to get drowned out. But this would be meaningful, and it would be a way, like, these club sides don't play each other. They just never do. So you would never see Northern Hemisphere teams play Southern Hemisphere teams. More recently, of course, the South African rugby franchises have joined the URC and are now playing against Northern Hemisphere teams. But previous to that, you just wouldn't play them. And it's super cool when you get to see that. And there's lots of debate and argument and people want to see it. And yeah, I guess basically this is planned to happen every 4 years. As I said, it's time to be the year post World Rugby World Cup. And I hope that moves. In the article from The Guardian that we'll link to, it's just the same year, and this is due to like where things lie. Firstly, The Guardian's a British publication, and their season sort of runs from mid-year onwards. So they have an August or so season that will then have 2027's Rugby World Cup, which will be in October, and this will then be the following year. So it's kind of the same season for them, so to speak. So that's why, for the Southern Hemisphere listeners, the format will be 8 teams from what is currently the Champions Cup. Champions Cup is taken from across the European rugby competitions, and then they play off in the Champions Cup, and then they have the Challenge Cup as well, which is a second-tier competition, which is the next group down. So they will take those Champions Cup teams, 8 of them, 6 from Super Rugby, and then 2 more, which are reportedly going to be the Japanese clubs, but that's yet to be confirmed and yet to be agreed upon from Japan. They're going to play across 4 weekends in June, and the problem with June is like that's where the Champions Cup is at the moment. So they're going to reschedule the whole European rugby calendar. And this does, like, for Southern Hemisphere people listening, they're like, what's the problem here? And we'll get to this because this is going to form like the crux of this conversation here. So basically what they're going to do is adjust the Challenge Cup. They're going to take these teams every 4 years and send them off. And the next group of teams are going to go and join the Challenge Cup basically. And they're going to have a knockout series. It'll be a bit different there for those, just for completeness for our Northern Hemisphere listeners. But the issues for scheduling have been that the finals for both hemispheres competition, so Super Rugby and, you know, take your pick of Premiership, Top 14, etc., they've all had to move to May so that they can facilitate this happening in June, which is the big thing. So Super Rugby then needs to start in January. And for those in the Southern Hemisphere, you'll appreciate that is approximately boiling, right? We talked about Berlin earlier, you gave me hell for it being 20 degrees. We're talking, if you're playing in Australia, it can be 30 plus for some of these games. So that's going to be brutal to have that start in January. It also means they do all their preseason before that over Christmas, which makes it hard for these guys as humans, right? And there are humans here behind it. Now, what it means for the Northern Hemisphere is the protected weekend for the Champions Cup is removed in the Northern Hemisphere. And this is put there, the protected weekends. And then the top 14 schedule is real heavy. So they've got 26 rounds plus 3 rounds of knockout, which is unheard of in the Southern Hemisphere. There's so much rugby. So much rugby. They've basically got no weekends off, with the exception of 1 or 2 weekends for some of the Six Nations and then some of the Champions Cup stuff where they play anyway. So it's not really a weekend off. But that's where the domestic league changes, which is just so much rugby. And they're probably going to need to, you know, the current season started in mid-August and had a pause for the Rugby World Cup. So like that's for some context. And again, August is hot here, right? These guys in the Southern Hemisphere, there's like this real time off and they have a real off season. In the Northern Hemisphere, it's kind of like you get a couple of weeks and then crack on again into your preseason. It's so much rugby.
You say so much rugby. I'm fascinated to see how this will play out for a number of reasons. So my main context and expertise lie in professional cycling, so because that's where I've worked the last 12 years. And when races like the Tour Down Under started being added in January to cycling and races in South America in February, it was good off-season, early season prep and riders to get themselves in shape. But people were then complaining that now the season is running from January to October, when you used to have Tour of Beijing as a world tour race and stuff like that. Whereas traditionally in cycling, the season would be like March to September, October-ish. So there's time for recuperation. In a sport like rugby, in cycling, you could almost manage it because you have squads. You have a squad of 30 riders, 32 riders. You take 6 to 8 riders to a race at any given time. So you could sort of maneuver and rest certain riders, etc. In rugby, my concern with so much rugby and more rugby is risk to injury. Surely that is going to go up significantly. And risk to injury in rugby, even though they have amazing laws protecting the game, etc., I think would, yeah, the risk would go up significantly. And what impact could that have on the greater game?
Yeah, you're spot on. And what this, so there's actually a couple of things happening. So one of them is pure risk of injury as a result of loading, which is what you're talking about. And that's 100% the case. And once you lose players, then quality decreases, right? So that's one issue. They do manage this a little bit because they have big squads. The European squads are enormous because you need it because of injuries, because of internationals. Like, you know, as I said, they don't really have big international breaks, some of these clubs. So as a result, what it changes is your squad makeup, because you have a bunch of guys, you want a bunch of young guys who are good, but not quite national team standard. And you also want a bunch of guys who are no longer playing national team. So guys who are from countries where you can't make the team, like All Blacks or former All Blacks who've gone to France, can't get picked for the All Blacks. So they become very valuable because they're going to form the crux of your team during the international window when you lose your international players. So that's another way of like squad construction. They do have rest like protocols around number of games, maximum games these guys are allowed to play and that sort of stuff, and need for rest. That certainly happens, which again speaks to the need for a squad and depth of squad and strength of squad. And they certainly do rest them a lot more. But that impacts quality of the game as well, which is what I was about to get to as the second point. Is like, you've got the more rugby you play, the more likely you are to dilute it, either through injury or needing to rest players or all of the above. Now, there's an argument. It makes it more exciting. It improves competitive balance, does all that stuff. Squad management's more important. All of those things are true, but you do certainly risk this, particularly in the context of like, yeah, just so much rugby. Like that, they're playing 26 games plus three knockouts plus now another 4 weeks of knockouts. That's 33 weeks of games plus internationals. You know, if you play those, obviously you're going to get some of those other games off, but like, that's so much rugby.
But I mean, if they can pull it off, I can see where there can be a place for it, and it might be really hard to fit into everyone's schedules and all the stakeholders and getting them to agree on timelines, etc. Because in football, you've got the Champions League, and the Champions League is the biggest thing in football because you have arguably the best league in the world, the Premier League in the UK, and then you have the biggest clubs in the world, like in Spain, Real Madrid, Barcelona, etc. You have Inter Milan from Italy, you have PSG in France, you have these big teams with big name players like Kylian Mbappe, who's playing in France, and then you have traditionally or in the past Leo Messi and Cristiano Ronaldo playing in Spain, who now get to play against, I don't know, Harry Kane from the UK and whatever, and play against Manchester United and Chelsea. So you have the biggest teams in the world with the biggest following coming together and playing each other, and it's prestigious because that doesn't happen week in, week out. There's a time, there's a place for it. It works really well with those respective domestic leagues. So if rugby can pull that off, I can see how a club World Cup can be very exciting for the sport.
The other thing to remember is in the Southern Hemisphere, you often lose players to Europe. And in South Africa, they're better at keeping track of them and where they go and that sort of stuff. But in Australia, it's kind of like, oh, the guy left and went to wherever. And because you can't get picked for the national team, you don't care. You're like, whatever, he's gone. But it's nice to see these players playing. And I found this when I moved to Europe. I was like, oh, I remember that guy. He was good. Like, I liked him. And you get to watch him again. And so you'll have these players coming back. And it also helps with basically where we're going for all countries soon, is that you're going to be able to be fit for your national team wherever you're playing. That's what we're moving to for everybody soon. And this will allow better comparison there, because now you get to see him play in context, or you understand where his club competition is, or all these things. So I think I'm excited for this to happen. You know, 2028 is when it's happening, so like, don't hold your breath, because yeah, you won't make it. But yeah, it'll be really cool to see where it goes. I'm excited to see where this happens. And I promise we won't only speak rugby and cycling on this podcast. It just so happens that this is where the news is. As always, if you do find a news article or you want us to talk about a topic, please do send us a DM or on Instagram or to an email, both of which, again, are in our show notes.
Before we wrap up, we do have a 1% better challenge for this month. And this month, we are challenging you to wear appropriate and accurate shoes to the gym. If you're someone who goes to the gym and you do strength work, I didn't know this. Dr. David Lipman gave me an education in not going to gym in my running shoes. That is not something that I knew. It's just something that most people, I think, do. And I thought that was the correct thing to do. But apparently, David, that is the incorrect thing to do. And we're talking about sole depth here and how big the sole is, I'm guessing.
Yep. And how soft they are. So go back to our first episode of the month. We go into it in a bit of depth there. We touched on it a little bit last week as well. So I won't belabor the regular listeners. But for those who are new, please jump across, jump back a couple episodes. You will hear that. And yeah, so Hard Souls, not too high off the ground. And yeah, enjoy your lifting. Enjoy the 1% gains, or maybe more than 1% gains. And let us know how you go. Tag us on social if you do it. And we did get one submitted privately recently, Zylan, but we've asked that person to kindly submit online. So we'll see if that happens.
Yeah. Follow us on Instagram and TikTok, 1% Better Pod. Thank you again to Precision Fuel and Hydration for supporting us on this podcast. We do have a discount code. You get 15% off your first order. So check out the show notes. Go have a look at the link over there. Click through that and enjoy your Precision Fuel and Hydration during your events. Absolute game changer. That they've been in our sporting career. So excited to have them on here. David, thank you so much for listening to me, I guess. Thank you to the listeners for listening to both of us.
Good. That's a good one, mate. I was going to say, like, I did some talking as well, but you're welcome that I listened. Thank you to all the listeners. I'll wrap up, mate, because I'm the professional here. Thank you to all the listeners. Please do subscribe to the podcast. It does help us grow. Share it with a friend who you think will enjoy it. That also helps us grow. And we were interested already. Please do visit the sponsors. So we really do appreciate you all. Follow us on socials. We already mentioned it, TikTok and Instagram. All links are in the show notes. We will talk to you again next week after Zylan's run the Two Oceans Ultra Marathon and after I am back from altitude. Thank you.